afternoon, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, brought to you in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken in my Friday reader seat. Today we're reading from West Branch, Iowa. I'm up visiting our daughter. We are for Christmas holidays. TH goes on, and so does my reading. So here we are with Friday, December 22nd edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. We begin now with our first piece from Above the Fold. County governments expecting significant insurance rate hikes. As area county governments build their budgets for the next fiscal year, they face major increases to required insurance coverage for property, equipment, and personnel that officials say will further stretch their ability to fund services. Tim English, agent and owner of O'Connor and English Insurance Agency, which represents Dubuque County, reported that the county's cost for insurance will increase 30% starting January 1st, and other counties are facing similar increases. The increases stem largely from insurance companies charging more to cover properties against extreme weather and natural disasters, which have grown more frequent in recent years due to climate change. But companies are also charging more for liability coverage for public officials and against cybercrime due to societal changes. All counties got 30% or more of an increase, English told the Dubuque County Board of Supervisors recently. With property losses and everything else, it's a perfect storm. It's the hardest market I've ever seen in my 43 years in the industry. An ICAP, Dubuque County's insurance company, Iowa Communities Assurance Pool, was formed in 1986 when it was a hard market for cities and counties. Dubuque County's total coverage will cost $840,204 in 2024, an increase of $192,598 from this year. Supervisor Harley Potoff said insurance premium increases for every sort of coverage are being felt across both the public and private sector. Everybody's insurance premiums are going up, he said. It's a nationwide thing. We've got a lot of weather-related incidents. Both county governments, by their nature, own a lot of property, parks, road department buildings, administrative offices, and more. We do have the fairgrounds, Sunnycrest Manor, and Dubuque Emergency Management with ICAP also, English said. And Dubuque County properties have seen their fair share of damage from recent severe storms, which are increasing both in frequency and intensity, officials said. They're being drawn on more, said Supervisor Ann McDonough of Insurance Policies. We've had several claims in the last 24 months for lightning strikes and other things. They call Iowa the Florida of the Midwest in terms of all the storms we've had the past few years, English added. According to Dubuque County Budget Director Stella Rundy, the county actually has been drawing more from its insurance than it paid in this year. English said ICAP paid $1.02 million in claims for every $1. That would be $1.02 in claims for every $1 Dubuque County paid in premiums in the past year. You can see that we are operating above our contribution in a lot of areas. Auto physical damage, public officials' liability, and law enforcement liability, Rundy said. So they are paying out more than we're putting in. That was one obstacle English said he found when looking for another insurance carrier in the hopes of finding a lower price. We tried to get an alternate quote, he said. Basically, ICAP is the only game in town right now. We could try to piece it out, quote it separately. The coverage is not going to be as broad and will probably be even more expensive than the ICAP program. Supervisor Wayne Kenneker pointed out that Dubuque County has a few new properties to insure. The increase obviously encompassed adding some facilities to that, he said. English acknowledged the property increase, but said the cost increase had much more to do with market prices. Those increases are being felt in other counties, too. Jackson County Supervisor Mike Steinis said he had been told to expect a 30% increase for 2024 and likely another increase of 20 to 30% in 2025, of which English also had warned the Dubuque County Supervisors. Steinis said he had heard from local private insurers that the increase was due to increased material costs to repair damage, as well as higher frequency of that damage occurring. 5 years ago, you could get your roof put on for $2,000. Now it would be $12,000, he said. Now, all of these issues with flooding in Florida and all of these disasters everywhere, I don't know where it ends. In addition to property coverage, Dubuque County also will see major cost increases to liability insurance for public officials due to both a growing number of threats against government officials nationally and increased litigation against them. ICAP also reduced Dubuque County's limit on cybersecurity coverage. Rundy said Dubuque County had projected a cost increase of 15% for insurance coverage when planning the current fiscal year's budget, so the county already will have to amend the budget upward in January. I know it's hard on Stella, English said. You can only go to the well so many times with increases. Iowa counties already are trying to plan a budget for next fiscal year without knowing if properties' taxable assessments will push their revenue growth over a 3% cap put in place by the Iowa legislature that would cap counties' ability to levy. We're not intending to tax anybody for anything we don't need to, Sinus said. And I know people talk about fluff, but we're going to replace two sheriff's vehicles and are now only going to be able to do one because of those cost increases. Our next piece is a large centerpiece with a picture of the old Dubuque Brewing and Malting Company building on Jackson Street and East 30th. And the title of the piece is Demolition Brewing. And what we have is some concern about part of the building coming down, is what the caption reads. Amid several delays, work to stabilize a deteriorating Dubuque building may not commence until next year, despite urging from city officials. Dubuque Housing and Community Development Director Alexis Steger informed city council members this week that she still had not received a final design for the stabilization plan for the Dubuque Brewing and Malting Company building at 3000 Jackson Street, even though the city gave building owner Steve Emerson an early December deadline to make the building safe again. Reached later in the week, Emerson said his engineers currently are assessing whether the condition of the southern portion of the building is safe enough to conduct stabilization work at all. He said if engineers determine that crews cannot safely work in that portion of the building, it likely will be demolished. We're looking at whether it makes sense to demolish the south section of the building if they can't safely get in it to do the work, Emerson said. That's what we're trying to work out right now. City officials have been demanding that Emerson stabilize the building since an analysis of the structure in August determined it to be a significant danger to the public, prompting the closure of Jackson Street from East 29th to East 32nd Street. While some work has been completed on the building, Dubuque Assistant Housing Director Mike Belmont said it remains unclear when additional required work to ensure the building is safe for the public will begin, though officials hope to receive the finalized plan soon. Dubuque City Council members previously expressed a desire to reopen the portion of Jackson Street near the Brewing and Malting Building before the end of the year, but Belmont and Steger said that now is unlikely to happen. We, too, are frustrated that it keeps getting pushed back, Belmont said. Emerson, a Cedar Rapids, Iowa-based developer, purchased the roughly 125-year-old brewing and malting company building in 2017, with plans to convert the structure into a combination of residential units and commercial space. While the project so far has failed to secure enough funding to move forward, Emerson said he intends to apply for federal low-income housing tax credits in April to fund the project, even if he does need to demolish a portion of the structure. "It's a two-section grant," Emerson said. "If we take down the southern section, we would still apply for funding for the north section." Speaking with council members this week, Steger said city staff met with engineers hired by Emerson to discuss preliminary plans submitted to the city to stabilize the structure. Those plans include installing a north-to-south bracing system for the Jackson Street-facing wall of the building. However, city staff questioned whether a west-to-east bracing system also would need to be installed in the building to prevent it from shifting in those directions. Furthermore, a memo submitted to council members states the city still is requiring Emerson's engineer to provide reasonable assurance that the bracing system will be a 12-month solution for keeping the public safe from collapse or falling debris. Steger said the engineer currently is reviewing drone footage and interior photos of the Brewing and Malting Company building to determine if the additional bracing system will be required. Dubuque City Council members expressed their continued frustration over the ongoing issues at 3000 Jackson Street and asked city staff to continue to update them on the status of the structure. "I think the frustration level is so high on this, and the concerns of the community are so frequent," said Mayor Brad Kavanaugh. "I think we should hear again about this in January." Steger said a plan is in place to deal with any snowfall on the closed portion of Jackson Street if it occurs before the road is reopened. Our final front page piece: She Unites connects area women in activities. When Nat Finley relocated to Dubuque from Muscatine, Iowa in 2020, she felt a disconnect. "I wanted to meet more people," said the 34-year-old photographer, entrepreneur, and owner of Nat Finley Photography. Specifically, she wanted to connect with other women who, like her, wanted to explore what the community had to offer, particularly if they were putting down new roots. Through a business connection, she met Adelaide Herman, another entrepreneur and transplant to Dubuque from Rochester, Minnesota. Nat and I became fast friends, but both wondered where the women's groups were in the area, said the 31-year-old graphic designer and marketing professional. "We couldn't be the only ones feeling this way about being disconnected from the community." It was during a New Year's Eve conversation that the two decided to seize the opportunity for a need they saw to help women connect with other women through community engagement. In 2021, the duo founded She Unites, a nonprofit that aims to connect women through unique programming opportunities, from its monthly gatherings with guest speakers at Dubuque's Creative Adventure Lab to what's known as recess, occasional Saturday morning or Wednesday night recreational activities that have featured hiking, biking, kayaking, snowshoeing, yoga, pickleball tournaments, self-defense classes, and more. "It's a group for women by women," Finley said. "We wanted to provide opportunities to help women not only connect with other women, but to get out of their comfort zones and educate them on things they might not know very much about. It has been very fun to watch and is particularly great for women who might find themselves a little more introverted or intimidated to try a new activity by themselves." The organization hosted its debut event at Dubuque's Smokestack. Thinking it would be a success if it drew at least 20 attendees, Finley and Herman realized just how much of a community need they were meeting when more than 100 women showed up. It was very eye-opening, Finley said. Since then, it has just continued to snowball. Drawing attendees primarily through word of mouth and social media, activities are open to all women. Our core group seems to be women in the ages of 25 to 45, but we've seen people in their 70s and 80s come to our events, Herman said. We always try to offer a wide variety of topics covered from guest speakers for women in all phases of life, as well as activities for all women to try. Most events also are free to attend or only require a minimal fee, thanks to partnerships with local businesses, event hosts, and sponsorships. Gatherings do not require pre-registration, while recess events do. We didn't want things like cost or membership to be a barrier, Herman said. They also didn't want the focus of the group to be business-driven. There are a lot of organizations in town that offer business-to-business connections, Finley said. We wanted this to look and feel different and to be more about women connecting through activities rather than just professional development. I think because we've kept that kind of a focus, we've been able to meet all kinds of cool women. For Mackenzie Marley, that kind of connection also helped her find her footing during a difficult moment. In 2021, I was going through a transitional period in my life, she said. She Unites gave me the support I desperately needed. This organization helped me understand and implement that we as women are owners of our actions. With each honest conversation, meaningful connection, and warm welcome, I became someone I was proud of. Bailey Peterson was encouraged to try She Unites after relocating to Dubuque during the COVID-19 pandemic. I was pretty isolated for about the first year I lived here, she said. I'm a relatively introverted person, so pushing myself to make friends in a new place was extremely daunting to me. I spent way more time than I should have alone. It was actually my boss and co-workers who nudged me to start attending She Unites meetings. I've been able to grow really close and meaningful friendships with these wonderful women in ways that don't strictly revolve around work. She Unites has been such a meaningful group to be a part of because it has allowed me to interact with and socialize with so many women within the Dubuque area, as well as to be able to think about and discuss topics I've not always been exposed to before. The organization also promotes diversity, engaging women from various walks of life. The best way to connect with people and find true treasures is by connecting, listening, and becoming open to change, said Arantrax Martinez Resendez. She Unites became a space where I found diversity within the community, met incredible women, and challenged my perspective. Attending their recess and gathering programs has been an opportunity to learn about other women's journeys and how to become a better support system for my community. She Unites recently launched its program lineup for 2024 and anticipates continued growth, perhaps even to other communities. Additionally, the organization has launched a podcast to keep conversations going between in-person events. Women truly are seeking the power and connection of other women, Finley said. They have great ideas and their energy is unmatched. We never thought we'd be running a nonprofit, but to be able to have created a space to bring women together like this, help them build relationships, and try something new has been very inspiring to me. And now our first Dubuque and Tri-State piece. It has a huge picture of a crane holding up an old caboose with no wheels on the bottom in between a number of buildings. And on the right side, one can see a little strip of railroad track and what will be the wheels that the caboose will sit upon. And the caption reads, a crew from A1 Crane Rental and Machinery Moving from Dubuque delivers a caboose to its new home at the Lafayette County Historical and Genealogy Society Depot Museum in Darlington, Wisconsin, on Thursday. And our article, Museum in Darlington lands caboose made in the 1930s. The Lafayette County Historical and Genealogy Society welcomed a new caboose to the Depot Museum in Darlington on Thursday. This project has been years in the making, said Bar Nemac, then president of the Historical Society Board of Directors. It is not a simple process to find a historical item of this size, let alone transport it. You can call it luck or fate, but really what it comes down to is that we have board members from all over the county who tapped into their connections to make this dream a reality. Earlier this year, a board member noticed the rail car on a property near Scales Mound, Illinois. With a little research, volunteers connected with the owner, Kevin Steyer. Steyer had purchased the caboose several years earlier with the intention to restore it, but sold it to the museum to give the piece of railway history a good home. Then, A1 Crane of Dubuque was contracted to load and transport the nearly 20-ton caboose to the Depot Museum. Lots of times, historians focus on clerical work. This time around, we got to do the Indiana Jones work of going out into the field and discovering something, said board member and archivist Jack Shannon. The caboose was built in the late 1930s by the Missouri Pacific Railroad Company. It will be restored in the style of Milwaukee Road Company to better represent the line that would have serviced Lafayette County and the surrounding area. Following the caboose's restoration, the Lafayette County Historical and Genealogy Society hopes to have it open to the public year-round. When operating, the caboose usually housed two workers, Shannon said. They would sleep in shifts, and one worker would always be watching for fire, broken wheels, and other dangers. We hope to restore the caboose with the tools and equipment that would have been present, as well as making it a welcoming space for visitors. The caboose is a natural extension of the Depot Museum, which has been a landmark in Darlington since it was built in 1889. The frame structure served as a railroad depot and warehouse, with two sets of tracks on either side. While one set of tracks has been repurposed as part of the Cheese County Trail, the second set has been cleared and restored to house the caboose. These are the remnants of the line that ran through Darlington and connected Mineral Point to Warren, Illinois. At the time, that was our access to the world, Nemec said. It transported goods, soldiers, and so much more. There are so many stories and so much history here, and we want to recognize that. While the project has been led by the Lafayette County Historical and Genealogy Society, it has been embraced by Darlington locals, organizations through Lafayette County, and railroad aficionados nationwide. The Society had some money set aside for this project, and we were able to receive some grants through the National Railway Historical Society. Individuals and charitable organizations throughout the country have contributed over $7,000, Nemec said. Total cost of the project will likely be about $20,000, organizers said. Our Chamber of Commerce is already thinking of ways to use the caboose for community events. The police department has been a fantastic resource in making sure it is in a secure space. This is a project our community can really be proud of. We now turn to our opinion page, and today's other view is another guest editorial. This one is by Jace Graves, who is an award-winning humor columnist from East Texas. And his piece is Haunted by the Kids of Christmas Past. Since two of my daughters are now in college and one in high school, Christmas just hits different. As those crazy kids and my not-so-secret, sort of, but not really guilty pleasure, Taylor Swift says these days. When I was up in the attic just after Thanksgiving, foraging for decorations and wondering how the ceiling hadn't caved in yet from all the future garage sale inventory stored up there, I accidentally opened a Rubbermaid tub full of Christmas-themed Little People toys we bought for the girls and me when they were toddlers. At that moment, a tsunami of nostalgia swept over me, and I basically played out the scene from Christmasification, where Clark Griswold sits trapped in the attic and gets all weepy while watching some old home movies he finds. If only I had a teal turban, a fur stole, and some pink gloves. Mixed with that nostalgia was the bittersweet, but mostly bitter, realization that Christmas is never going to be like it was when the girls were little and I transformed into a more enthusiastic version of Buddy the Elf on about November 1st every year. For example, we've been shocked at how few gifts the girls have asked for in the past couple of Christmases. I mean, I still have to resist sending my own parents my Christmas list in triplicate. Last year, the girls asked for a trip to New York City, where we got stranded by the airlines during a Christmas polar blast and froze our Big Apples off. This year, instead of traditional gifts, the girls mainly have asked for money. It's like they've all turned into Sally from A Charlie Brown Christmas, when she asks Santa for tens and twenties. I, on the other hand, am going to feel like Don Vito Corleone on Christmas morning, standing by the tree in my Christmas PJs, handing over rolled-up wads of cash. I even had to decorate the big Christmas tree in our front window by myself this year. Our older daughters were away at college. My youngest daughter was busily wasting valuable time with homework and studying, and my wife was frivolously doing laundry, paying bills, and keeping our whole household from collapsing. Since I was alone, I don't think I even bothered putting on pants until I was almost done and realized all the blinds were open. My apologies to the neighbors. Speaking of our youngest daughter, she surprised us this year by asking when, not if, Elfie, our now elderly elf on the shelf, was going to come out. Now, I don't think she still believes in the Christmas magic of Elfie. Instead, she is either just reveling in the childish merriment of the season or enjoying our suffering as we feebly try to remember to help poor old lint-infested Elfie move every night. I think I'll just tell her he's having mobility issues in his old age. Despite all of the changes, I'm still going to do my best to enjoy the Christmas holiday. Whether I'm focusing my daughter or forcing my daughters to ride in the car, sighing and gawking at their phones while my wife and I look at Christmas lights, or I'm quoting funny movie lines from Christmasification and A Christmas Story, until my daughter's eyes roll completely out of their skulls, I'm determined to have some fun. And for their sake, I hope the ATM is open on Christmas Eve. We have one letter to the editor. Haley, best candidate for Chief Executive Office. Tom Van Gelder, North Rocky Road, East Dubuque, Illinois. 'Tis the season of hyperbolic hullabaloo. No, I don't mean Christmas. 'Tis also the season of pander and slander. Yes, it is presidential election time. The office of president has vastly grown in power over the years, and yet the president presides over only the executive branch. The executive branch is intended to administer the laws passed by the legislative branch, with the legal boundaries decided by the courts. The courts set these boundaries through cases brought to them by the people. This is a very cool system, but each of us would like to be a dictator, so pandering presidents give their supporters an intoxicating taste of that lust for power. Into this fray has come the most level-headed person seeking the office of president in quite a while. Nikki Haley. I believe that Ambassador Haley has the best chance to keep the runaway train of the chief executive office from derailing. A woman, the daughter of legal immigrants, a person of color, a conservative, an accountant, and she is fearless in the face of overwhelming odds. But many are enamored of the Donald, a man that is too old, too toxic, and too darn ornery to lead this country forward on the best path. He may be being railroaded, but he should focus on his defense as an ex-president, not while president. Iowans, you have a chance to make real history and help to right the ship of state. Support Nikki Haley in your caucuses. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, brought to you in part by the R.W. Hafer Foundation from DePaco. This is Ken, and I am reading and will continue to be reading from the Friday, December 22nd edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And we now turn to today's obituaries. Deborah Callahan. Deborah Daisy Callahan, 67, of Dubuque, passed away Tuesday, December 19th, after a long battle with COPD. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, December 23rd, at Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road, Dubuque, where there will be a funeral service held at 2 p.m. on Saturday. Deacon John Stearman will officiate. Interment will be in St. John's Cemetery, Placid. Debbie was born January 2nd, 1956, in Dubuque, the daughter of Lester and Lillian McDermott Callahan. She attended Cathedral School when she wasn't sneaking out and went on to raise two daughters, Lori and Carrie, Kurt. Along with her best friend, Jean Capp, she owned and operated D&J's cleaning service for 30 years until retirement. Debbie had many hobbies, including boating, roller skating, and singing karaoke. She loved going to the Dubuque Farmers Market and hitting the casinos with her siblings. Debbie enjoyed boot scooting, even taught a few classes, which brought her a wonderful group of friends, especially at the Crazy Horse and Instant Replay. Her very favorite thing was to spend time with her grandchildren and FaceTime her great-granddaughter. Carl F. Stainer, Dyersville. Carl F. Stainer, 87, of Dyersville, passed away Wednesday, December 20th at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 2 to 6 p.m. Tuesday, December 26th at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville. Visitation will continue at Kramer Funeral Home from 9 to 10 a.m. prior to funeral mass. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, December 27th at St. Francis Xavier Basilica in Dyersville, with committal service at the cemetery chapel. Reverend Chris Parhashki will officiate. Carl was born July 5th, 1936 in Monticello, Iowa, the son of Cyril and Mary Rollinger Stanner. He served in the U.S. Army from 1957 to 1961. Then he worked at John Deere for 33 years. He married Claudine Pasker December 24, 1986, in Dubuque. After retiring from John Deere, Carl and Claudine enjoyed camping, fishing, and traveling. Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville is assisting the family, and information is available at www.kramerfuneral.com. Memorials may be sent to the family in care of Kramer Funeral Home, 750 12th Avenue Southwest, Dyersville, 52040. Gerald R. Alberhosky, Iowa City. Gerald Raymond Alberhosky, 77, died peacefully Sunday, December 17th at UIHC. Massive Christian burial will be celebrated at 10 a.m. Friday, December 29th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church, Iowa City. Visitation will be Thursday, December 28th, from 3:30 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service, Iowa City. The rosary will be recited at 3 p.m. The service will be live-streamed on the St. Mary Catholic Church, Iowa City, YouTube page. Burial with military honors will be at St. Joseph Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Mary's Catholic Church or the Regina Foundation. Jerry was born April 22, 1946, in Iowa City, the son of John and Irma Marie Petrock Albrowski. Jerry was a 1964 graduate of Regina High School and served in the U.S. Navy during the Vietnam War. On May 8, 1971, Jerry married Betty Faust of Iowa City. Jerry was the co-owner of John's Grocery, a family business founded in 1948. Jerry was a lifelong member of St. Mary's Catholic Church, where he served as an usher and sang in the choir. Jerry was a St. Louis Cardinal and Iowa Hawkeye fan. He was a blood donor and organ donor. Jerry had a great smile, a great sense of humor, and loved great jokes. Online condolences may be shared at www.lensingfuneral.com. Donald R. Schmidt, Holy Cross. Donald R. Schmidt, 83 of Holy Cross, passed away Friday, December 15th. Private graveside services were held at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery, Rickardsville. Donald was born September 29, 1940, son of Raymond and Anna Marie Arlen Schmidt. He farmed in the Holy Cross area. Eaglehoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory is in charge of arrangements. Inga Berg, Stockton. Inga Berg, 76 of Stockton, died Wednesday, December 20th. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 27th at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hanover, where services will follow. Burial will follow in Evergreen Cemetery in Hanover. We'll now turn to some news in brief. And one from the page we're on, city not requiring green sticker on one extra bag of trash next week. The City of Dubuque announced that residents who use its solid waste services can set out one extra bag of trash this holiday season. All customers will be allowed one additional 35-gallon bag or container up to 40 pounds without the usually required green sticker Tuesday, December 26th through Saturday, December 30th, according to a press release. There is no collection on Christmas Day, December 25th. City officials also encourage residents to recycle and compost when possible. Most hard plastics labeled number 1 to number 5 are recyclable, along with cardboard and paper. Napkins, paper placemats, and most food products, other than meat and dairy, can be composted through the city's collection program. More information is available at cityofdubuque.org/rethinkwaste. And our next little piece I found, Western Dubuque Marching Band to play at ReliaQuest Bowl on New Year's Day. From Epworth, Western Dubuque High School's Bobcat Marching Band will perform in the ReliaQuest Bowl at Raymond James Stadium in Tampa, Florida, home of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, New Year's Day, Monday, January 1st. The ReliaQuest Bowl will feature the University of Wisconsin against Louisiana State University. The band will join with other high school band members from across the U.S. to perform a medley of popular and patriotic music. During its visit, the band will also perform in the ReliaQuest Bowl New Year's Eve Parade and Pep Rally in Uber City, Florida. And will participate in a concert and jazz band clinic. The ReliaQuest Bowl will be televised New Year's Day at 11 a.m. on ESPN2. I found one more tri-state piece to read before we finish up with our news in brief. Local pastorate distributes baskets to help lonely people over holidays. From Cascade. While most think to give to children in nursing homes during the holiday season, some communities have overlooked lonely people who can fall through the cracks. These people are the target of the St. Thomas Aquinas Pastorate Christmas Basket Program. The effort was founded more than a decade ago by the Cascade Area Church's Social Justice Committee. There's a lot of aspects to social justice, said Bobby Shell, program founder and former Social Justice Committee member. Some of them are community involvement, to bring all four of our parishes together, and doing an event that met a need of some people in the parishes. Are there people who are lonely, who are shut in, or need to know that there are others thinking of them in what can be a sad time of year? There's always lots of projects being done for children, but not always projects for the elderly or shut-ins. Pastorate Secretary and Social Justice Committee member Shelley Schemmel said, sometimes it's someone who's lost a spouse this year, a family that's lost a child, traumatic events, a bad accident, or battling a severe cancer. One guy sent us a letter a few years back and said, it was very nice to get the soup and cookies, but what I really appreciate is that someone thought of me during the season. Basket preparation begins with a call for volunteers each year in the bulletin after Thanksgiving, as well as a request for recommendations for who could use a basket that Christmas. Roughly 50 baskets are made each year by an average of 24 volunteers before being blessed by the pastor. Schemmel said people can call the pastorate office to contribute in any way, from making food to obtaining the baskets to packing and making bows. A lot of people want to do something to help our community, and this is a way for them to give if they can't give monetarily, Schemmel said. A lot of people are very proud of the things they can make. Schell said, St. Peter's at Temple Hill had started a soup and bread supper, a basic meal. So we started with our baskets having homemade soups and breads. Then it led to adding some cookies and candies for the first few years. Then we thought we should do something a bit healthier and added fruit. So now it's a bit of everything. One year, we didn't put cookies in it, and that didn't go over well. The baskets always are put together and dispersed on a Friday. During the first years, the distribution was a full event with caroling. However, recent years have seen more trouble finding groups of people to deliver and distribution is taken care of by individual groups, such as families or coffee groups, at a time of their choosing over the weekend. And with this article, we have a lovely picture of a group of women, obviously putting baskets together. They're very lovely, different kinds of wicker baskets and all kinds of things on the table that they're putting in. And then they're putting transparent bags or cellophane over them and tying them with lovely bows, red and gold and such. And beneath it, we have the caption of who they are. Mary Kay Latham, Marie Thomas, and Donna Clawkey. Bag up Christmas baskets recently at the end of a volunteer assembly line in the St. Matthias Parish Hall in Cascade. Now we'll turn back to our news in brief. Trial date set for woman accused of poisoning husband in Wisconsin. From Argyle, Wisconsin. A trial date has been set for a woman accused of repeatedly poisoning her husband in Lafayette County. Amanda A. Chapin, 51, is charged in Lafayette County Circuit Court with attempted first-degree intentional homicide. Her trial is set to begin July 29th. Authorities reported that Chapin poisoned her husband, veterinarian Gary Chapin of Argyle, three times in July and August of 2022 by putting barbiturates, animal euthanasia drugs, in his coffee. A criminal complaint states that following their wedding in March 2022, Chapin forged the signature of one of her husband's children on a power of attorney document and demanded that her husband amend his house deed so she would get the home if he died. The complaint states that Chapin poisoned her husband for the first time less than 3 weeks after the quitclaim deed on his house was authorized. The third time that Gary Chapin drank the allegedly poisoned coffee in August of 2022, he fell into a coma that lasted 4 days, documents state. Blood work showed barbiturates in his system came from the drugs used to euthanize animals. Dubuque woman sentenced for making threat to boyfriend while displaying knife. A Dubuque woman has been sentenced to 2 days in jail and 2 years of probation for threatening her boyfriend with a knife. Perea M. Smith, 21, recently received a sentence from Iowa District Associate Judge Robert Richter in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County after pleading guilty to charges of domestic assault while displaying a weapon and fourth-degree criminal mischief. As part of a plea deal, a charge of going armed with intent was dropped. Court documents state that Smith was involved in a disturbance with her boyfriend, Jermaine R. Brown, 24, on November 19th, when she retrieved a knife from their kitchen and threatened to stab Brown. Brown left the residence, and Smith then left the residence with a hammer in her hand and broke the windshield of Brown's vehicle, causing $500 worth of damage, documents state. Felony charge against Dubuque man dismissed, but related case continues. A felony charge has been dismissed against a Dubuque man, though a related case involving a lesser charge continues. Mirsad Masinovic, 51, previously was charged in Iowa District Court of Dubuque County with going armed with intent and disorderly conduct. Iowa District Associate Judge Mark Hostegger recently dismissed the going armed with intent charge on a motion by prosecutors. Assistant County Attorney Amanda Lassance requested the dismissal, stating in court documents that after a review of the evidence, the elements as charged are not met. The disorderly conduct case remains open. The charges stem from a November 30th incident in which police said Masinovic began to argue with another man at a residence in the 2600 block of Owen Court. Court documents state Masinovic verbally threatened the man, and the two also engaged in a physical fight. Video captured by a witness at the scene shows that after being punched by the man, Masinovic got up off the ground with a knife in his hand and rushed toward him before the two ended up being separated by others at the scene, documents state. Well, enough of all of that. Let's see what's going on this weekend. So we now have our weekend buzz. The noteworthy things to do this weekend in the tri-state area. Top of the list, Isthmus Brass at the Mineral Point Opera House. Today, Mineral Point Opera House, 139 High Street in Mineral Point, Wisconsin. Doors open 6 p.m., show begins 7 p.m. Wisconsin's largest premier brass ensemble will perform festive favorites. This year's program includes works from Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite featuring a tribute to Duke Ellington's arrangement. Admission, $25 to $50 plus fees. Tickets and more information are available at tinyurl.com/isthmus, that's I-S-T-H-M-U-S, Isthmus Brash, M-P-O-H. Not Quite Brothers. Today, Mississippi Moon Bar, 301 Bell Street, 8 p.m. Central Iowa's fastest growing cover band isn't your typical or technical brother act. The band brings an eclectic set list, high energy, and all ages appeal to the Moon Bar. Must be 21 and over to attend. Standing room only. General admission, $15 per person. Tickets and more information, tinyurl.com/moonbarnqb. Cirque du Bourg, drag cabaret, Cirque du Bourg. Drag Cabaret, my goodness. Saturday and Sunday, Smokestack, 62 East 7th Street. Doors open at 9 p.m., show starts at 10 p.m. Anna May and other Midwest drag artists put on a one-of-a-kind show both nights. Must be 21 and over to attend. Seating's limited, standing room available. Tickets available at the door. General admission is $15 per person. More information, smokestackdbq.com. Reflections in the Park, taking place through January 1st, Lewis Murphy Park, 1700 South Grandview Avenue, 5 to 10 p.m. daily. Hillcrest Family Services' annual fundraiser is a Dubuque holiday tradition. Admission, $12 per vehicle at the gate, or $10 if purchased at Dubuque Bank and Trust. More information, tinyurl.com/reflectionspark. Well, that brings us to the end of what I have to read today. This has been Ken, And I have been reading from the Friday, December 22nd edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. Remember that all of this, including my wonderful voice, is brought to you by IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, supported in part by DUPACO and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. As I say every week, don't just tune us in for the news Monday through Friday. Turn that dial, find your program guide, whatever it takes. There's all kinds of other good listening out there on IRIS, a program that's designed for any one of you who just wants to sit down and listen and be entertained. Have yourselves a happy holiday, however you may be celebrating it, and best wishes to all of you as we approach the new year.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.